Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case. Hello and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Linda, and I'm here with five fabulous fictionists, Nicola, Heather, Pat, Stephanie, and Teresa.
Hi!
Well, today we're going to be talking about thrillers, and a little later on we're going to be hearing from Laura Marshall, who's the author of Friend Request and about to launch Three Little Lies, a book that will be coming out at the end of June. We're going to talk about our favorite thrillers. Nicola is going to be reading to us from her work in progress. And later we'll hear about what's on Heather's bedside table. But first, Pat is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Okay, are we ready?
Yep.
Yes.
First published in 1933, the book is a largely autobiographical affair, a loosely fictionalized account of the boarding school period and expulsion that was to overshadow the author's life.
Ooh. Of a boarding school.
Okay.
I better have another clue.
Yeah. This was the first book published by Virago Press in 1978 as a modern classic. Virago's Donna Coonan describes it as the inspiration for the entire Virago modern classic list. And why, as she explains, Carmen Khalil loved it so much that she almost obsessively wondered how she could publish it. Then there was an epiphany moment and the VMCs came along into being.
Very good. I have read some, I went through a phase of reading quite a lot of the Virago modern classics, but it's not quite...
Okay.
Not sure. I've got two possibilities.
I've got a maybe.
Okay, third clue. Nanda Gray, the daughter of a Catholic convert, is 9 when she's sent to the convent of Five Wounds. Convent life, as Nanda finds, is truly a life of its own, complete with its own routines and rituals, where stockings aren't merely folded at night, but spread, quote, over the top of clothes in the form of a cross, where looking glasses are forbidden, where students, in a bid to mortify taste, voluntarily sprinkle salt rather than sugar on their rhubarb, where, when they sleep, they do so not snuggled on their sides, but on their backs, with their hands neatly folded over their chests. That way, if the dear Lord were to call you to himself during the night, you would be ready to meet him, as a Catholic should.
No, I don't think I've got it. I thought it might be my brilliant career, but I don't think it is.
I have no clue.
Antonia.
Oh.
Is it Antonia? You got it?
No. It's Frost in May by Antonia White.
I haven't read that. I'm going to have to read it.
Yeah, apparently she suffered from, well, she was incarcerated in Bedlam in 1922.
I'm definitely reading it.
She was on to her third husband by the time she was 30. And she also suffered from chronic writer's block, she claimed, had its roots in her expulsion from a Catholic boarding school.
Wow. I have read an Antonia White. I think it was called Villette.
Villette's Charlotte Bronte.
I have read an Antonia White. I've got it at home and it's something like. She writes about madness a lot.
It's a long, long time since I read it.
You got us. Very good. So if you guessed that one, well done.
Yeah. That's great. Okay, and now it's time to hear from Nicola, who's going to be reading from her work in progress, part of the Taurus Trilogy. Yes. I can't wait to see what happens next. These people have crashed into the forest and then, okay.
Yeah, well, we're not reading in sequence. I'm writing as scenes occur to me.
Oh, and, you are, okay.
So this one is set very swiftly after the opening chapter where the ambulances and the people are working on Brienne.
Oh, okay.
And this happens, this is the next section on from that, really.
Is it, so this follows the very first scene that we had?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it
okay,
does.
Okay, thanks.
Brienne woke with that sickening sense of falling you sometimes get in dreams and threw her arms out in the ancient human reflex to catch anything that might save her. She clutched at smooth, cool cotton sheets and sat up gasping, heart pounding as if it would burst out of her chest. The room was white, glowing white, stretching as far as she could see. It was cool, but not cold, bright, but not sunny, and silent, totally silent. There was a low mist on the floor which moved as if there was a breeze, but she could feel no air movement on her skin. She was the only occupant. I'm in a bed, was her first thought. That means I've failed. A sense of overwhelming despair came over her and she lay down again. Hot, painful tears welled in the corner of her eyes, which she squeezed shut to block out the inevitable sight of the pitying, or worse, disgusted looks of the nurses and doctors who would surely come now she'd woken up. Must be some kind of hospital, or more probably a loony bin. Oh well, that means knives and needles and drugs to try again with. She shut down again, going into a kind of half-sleep, fleeing her painful feelings. Sometime later, Brienne sat up again and looked around. There was a puzzling lack of equipment and instruments around the bed, which seemed to be almost floating on the glowing white floor. No doors, no windows, no ceiling, nothing else at all, in fact. She stood up, feeling the need to be ready, ready to run, to fight, to face whatever was coming next. Which was way too soon, apparently, as she immediately felt violently sick and bending over, threw up over and over again until there was nothing left and she felt turned inside out. Wiping her mouth on the back of her hand, she finally straightened up and immediately spotted a darker doorframe shape appear some way off as someone opened a door suddenly. "I'm sorry, I fell ill and there was nothing here to be sick in," she called to the tall man walking towards her. He was dark-haired, kind-looking, wearing a light suit, but not a doctor's coat, and no sign of a stethoscope round his neck. "Don't worry, it happens to everyone. I'll get it cleaned up. Why don't you sit on the bed again until you get your sea legs back?" He reached out and gave her a damp cloth and a bowl to wipe her hands and face with. "Where did that come from?" Brienne asked. "Don't worry about that now. We have more important things to talk about." He sat on a chair that appeared by the bed and crossed his elegant legs. She sat on the bed and held on to the end of the white-painted frame, feeling a bit woozy again. A smaller doorframe shape appeared off in the distance and a quiet hum announced the arrival of a silver dome shape which floated towards them through the low mist. It busied itself cleaning up after her, muttering quietly to itself. "I don't know, why don't they give the patients an orientation class in manifesting what they need in the moment? Would save so many drone hours. Downright wasteful, I call it." It whirred about for a couple of minutes, then took itself off through the door it had appeared from, exuding exasperation. Brienne looked over at the man who was examining his perfectly manicured hands, resting lightly on his crossed knee. There was no way to read his expression. "Get it over with, then, the pep talk, the telling off. But I'm telling you now, it won't do any good. My mind's made up, and I'll just try again, first chance I get." He sighed and looked up at her slowly. His eyes burned with a hot intensity, and a painful jolt went right through her. This man could see right into her soul, she realised in shock. She suddenly felt about 7 years old.
Yeah, good. Mm. Very good. Mm. Yeah, I thought it was really good. And yeah. The first time I read it, I just thought I can't find anything to critique. But then I had another go. So
well done, Teresa.
I will find something to critique. But I thought one of the things, perhaps I've said before, but with science fiction, the technology has to be believable, so it can't be too far away. Mm. And I felt that you've got that just right. That mm-hmm. we are almost at the point where we can control things with brainwaves, and we have 3D printers, and we have all these things. So it doesn't seem too far fetched. This manifestation, robots with personality. I'm sure that is being worked on now. Mm. I think that is absolutely.
Yes. Yes. You get sat
yeah.
nerves that go.
Yes.
That have personality.
Yes.
Want to be abused.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think she
wants
to clean up
after. No. It's exactly. So I thought all of that was brilliant. I found the writing really pretty much faultless. It flows from one sentence to the next. We follow Brienne's train of thought, experience her confusion, see what she sees, try to make sense of it. I think you have a natural flair for rhetoric, by which I mean writing a well-balanced sentence. Or I know you like the threes, but that works very well. But I just think you write really, really well.
Yeah.
Mm. Exciting.
Considering this is your first word for fiction. It's incredibly good, I think.
Yeah,
I expected when she stood up, though, since there was a mist on the floor, I kind of expected she would just fall through.
Her feet disappeared in the mist.
Yeah, yeah. But I thought it was quite good. I don't have anything to fault myself. Is my critique is I like it very much.
Well, doing what you're doing.
Yeah. There's a couple of areas where you had a few typos, I think, but you corrected those as you spoke. So, like, you've got a full stop. Whatever was coming next, which was way too soon. You've actually started the sentence with which was way too soon. But when you read that, you didn't read it like that, so you corrected it as you went. I love that opening. Waking with the sense of falling and throwing her arms out in the ancient human reflex. I thought that's very descriptive. I think you might want to rejig that sentence so that you don't address the reader directly. You sometimes get in dreams.
Oh, that's okay.
The actual tenor of the sentence I think is brilliant. As she's already observed that the room is white, glowing, stretching as far as she could see, that to think I'm in bed is her first thought. She's seen too much already, so I would bring that further up. So that I'm in bed is her first thought. Because she's had a lot of thoughts before then, you've just let us in on
Before the room was white.
You've used painful twice in a quite short space of time. Mm-hmm. Sometime later Brienne sat up and looked around. I don't think you need that sentence.
Okay.
Because
it's superfluous.
It's superfluous, and also it's quite bland in the context of the rest of it. You know?
And it gets rid of one of the agains, which I noticed as you were reading it, you're saying again in three sentences, so that's quite good.
And the other thing I noticed was he reached out and gave her a dab cloth and a bowl to wipe her hands and face with. She didn't wipe her hands with the bowl, she wiped her hands with the
that's a grammar thing.
He reached out and gave her a damp cloth and a bowl to wipe her hands and face with.
But this is what we're reduced to, finding
my only comment with was the sense of overwhelming despair came over her. But when you read it out, because the next one, eyes which she squeezed them shut, and you missed the them out.
I love the description of the man at the end. That was great.
Mm-hmm.
And you felt that intensity.
I like the room. The room, white, glowing white, stretching as far as you can see, cool but not cold, bright but not sunny, silent.
So this is where I mean about really the rhetoric, the rhythm of the sentence.
The flow for me actually was at the beginning. The room was white, glowing white, stretching as far as you could see. And I was like confused as to whether that was just your description of like brilliant white, but used glowing instead of brilliant, or whether you meant it was literally glowing. Now, whether that could be made any clearer.
It wasn't magnolia white, that's for sure.
No.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely wanted to convey a sort of glow. Glowing feeling.
I thought it was good.
I want one of those little robot things to come.
They do exist, those little Hoover things. But have you?
Yeah, but they don't clear up sick.
And does it answer back?
It doesn't answer back. It doesn't talk to itself.
That's an actually vacuum of floors.
There's some very funny videos of babies riding around on those if you do a search on YouTube. So what's going to happen after this is now he's going to explain to her that what's happened and why she's not off the hook.
Can kind of feel that's coming.
Why was she sick?
Because she was just disorientated from
She's had an overdose and
when I sat down to write it that wasn't going to happen, but I just thought you'd feel so disorientated. What's the normal physical reaction to that?
Well,
there's my notes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nicola. Yeah. Well, Teresa's now going to give us a word of the week, which is very interesting always when Teresa has a word of the week. Let's see what she's got planned now.
Well, my word of the week is not a real word. Or is it?
Uh-huh.
This is a mispronunciation, I think, that we hear a lot. I hear it a lot on TV. And so the word that I'm going to talk about is mischievous,
mm-hmm.
which I would have said is not a word. The word is mischievous,
mm-hmm.
but there is this tendency to put an extra I in after the V and say mischievous, which
who
is...
Who does that?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I don't know if Americans do it. Have you come across it, Linda?
I've never noticed it on the BBC
and in various presenters on TV.
Mischievous is what we say.
I don't think it's an Americanism as such.
Yeah.
That didn't come out in my research anyway. Okay. The Urban Dictionary refers to the common and disgusting mispronunciation and or spelling of the word mischievous and says there is no yuss about it. He's very rude about people who insist that mischievous is an alternate pronunciation. I can't read what he says about them. I found on grammarist.com an article called Mischievous versus Mischievous. And there they say mischievous is the standard spelling of the adjective meaning causing mischief, and mischievous is a misspelling, quite clear there. But it's so common that it may someday gain acceptance. And this is what I was kind of interested, how the language changes. For now, it doesn't regularly appear in edited writing, and dictionaries and spell check have yet to accept it. So he gives many instances from the 17th century, he or she, I should say, I don't know who wrote the website, where mischievous has crept into print. But the misspelled form is rare in 21st century published writing because spell check catches it. So that was quite interesting. And then on Spelling Trouble Blogspot, I found that the origins of the word lie in the Anglo-Norman word mischievous, meaning troublesome, itself derived from mischief, which is made up of the prefix mis added to the word chief or meaning head. Early spellings tended to preserve the Anglo-Norman original with mischievous. The correct spelling today is mischievous, no I after the B.
Right.
Although many people spell it erroneously thus. But, however, it turns out that this misspelling may come from a variant pronunciation, which was a valid alternative until about around 1700. So I say mischievous, but the variant pronunciation that we're referring to is mischievous, which you do hear. Some people say mischievous, and that seems to lend itself or to move into mischievous. It's now considered non-standard. In a pronouncing dictionary of 1802, the editor considered mischievous as a vulgarism, concluding that in language, as in many other cases, it is safer to be wrong with the polite than right with the vulgar. I'm not sure I agree with that. But surprisingly, the pronunciation of the word with four syllables, mischievous, does go back to the 15th century when that was a common spelling.
Mm.
So probably due to replacing the less common O-U-S ending with the more common I-O-U-S found in words like envious, furious and curious.
Well,
there's a couple of words that I commonly hear mispronounced and they drive me absolutely bonkers. One is when people say communal instead of communal.
Yes.
And the other one is when people say without further ado, but they actually say without further ado.
Oh, yeah.
I just think, oh, God.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
One fell swoop, which is from Shakespeare, is often said one foul swoop. That comes out a lot. But when I spoke to Jill Simpson, I asked her about this, and she said, yeah, it may well become the norm. This is what happens.
Yeah.
The language moves, and what is a mistake now could become the standard spelling later on.
Going back to your communal and communal, I don't know that either is right or wrong. I think there's no difference in the spelling of both words.
No.
I think it might be regional. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
communal is when it's of the community, and communal is when you take communion.
Oh, the communion. Yeah, she said communal.
Right.
Yes.
Right, yeah. It's communal and communal.
So yeah, communal, it's, yeah. It's just a variant to mishear it. If you mishear it like that, then it's easy to guess.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, if you're familiar with a word that you've read but you haven't heard spoken, then you will mispronounce, or you may mispronounce it.
Oh, I am famous for this because I read so much as a child and didn't actually hear anyone speaking the words, mispronounce things all my life.
I have friends who read all the Harry Potter books. And about Harry and Hermione one.
Without further ado, we're going to hear from Laura Marshall, the author of Friend Request, and she has a new book coming out, Three Little Lies, the end of June. And she writes thrillers. And she's going to tell us a bit about that, and then we're going to talk about our favourite thrillers. So, welcome, Laura.
We're very fortunate to be joined by Laura Marshall, author of Friend Request, which I know many of you will have read. It was named as one of the best new novels of 2018 by the Independent newspaper. And it's currently at the top of Amazon's psychological thrillers bestseller lists. And more than two-thirds of people on Goodreads have rated it four or five stars. So it's a very popular book. And so we're delighted to welcome Laura to Write Club the podcast. Hello, Laura.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
Good. We wanted to talk to you about your work and particularly about thriller writing. Mm-hmm. And Val McDermid famously said that she found out as a child that making up stories was infinitely more interesting than listening to boring grown-ups. So when did you start making up stories?
Yes, definitely as a child. I mean, I used to love making up stories. I think actually when I was at school, we had more opportunity to make up stories than they seem to nowadays. My children are at primary school and they don't often seem to get the chance to make up stories completely based on, you know, anything they like. Mm. My mum actually brought me a load of my primary school storybooks that she'd had in her loft. And that was quite interesting.
How wonderful.
Yeah, and lots of the stories were actually quite dark. I was only kind of 8 or 9.
So you've always been a thriller writer.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. There was stories about a man breaking into the house with a knife in the middle of the night and things like that. I was like, oh my God, I really have always been a crime writer.
How fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, what a wonderful legacy for your mum to keep for you.
Yeah, no, it's lovely to have.
Yeah, brilliant. So your stories were thrillers from the very beginning?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, all of them at that age, but certainly, I mean, certainly that was always the kind of book I was going to write. It's what I love to read. And so when I kind of really decided to make a go of it, sort of 2 or 3 years ago, I just had this idea about a woman getting a friend request from a girl who had supposedly been dead for 25 years. Just a sort of seed of an idea, but it was always going to be a thriller because just that's the books I love.
Yeah.
I don't really know how to write any other kind of book, I don't think.
And lots of great twists and turns. So did you have any formal education with creative writing beyond what we all went through at school? Or
well, I didn't at the time, no, but I had this, as I say, I had this seed of an idea about this from a quest from someone that was meant to be dead, but I didn't really feel that I knew how to go about writing a novel because I thought, well, you know, you could write the idea for the book in one page. How do you make that into 100,000 words? I just really felt that I needed some guidance. So I asked around about creative writing courses and somebody recommended the Curtis Brown Creative Novel Writing course.
Yeah.
So I applied for that and luckily I was accepted. So I started that in November 2015. That was a 3-month course. Well, I mean, just once a week, you know, not a full time thing.
Yeah.
And I arrived on the first day of that with 2 chapters of the book that would eventually become Friend Request.
Fabulous. And they kind of held your hand through the process.
Yeah, it was really useful just in terms of kind of structure and creating suspense. And I was lucky enough that my tutor was Erin Kelly, who is a brilliant psychological thriller writer. Really just by chance, I just applied for the next course that was coming up and it happened that she
turned out,
it was perfect. She was the perfect teacher for me. And also just getting that feedback from the other people on the course and also giving feedback on the others' writing was really helpful because I think it, you know, when you have to look at someone else's writing critically, I think it helps you to look at your own.
Sure. Well, that's wonderful. So which writers, you said that you love to read psychological thrillers and thrillers and crime. So which writers do you think have influenced you the most?
Well, certainly early days, Agatha Christie. I mean, I used to love, as a teenager, I read a lot of Agatha Christie, and I still enjoy reading her, actually. So, you know, she was probably the first one. Then I think around 20 years ago, I read a book called The Memory Game by Nikki French. And I think that was the first, which I loved. And I think that was the first one I read that I would say was a psychological thriller or a psychological suspense, you know, because it's not police procedural. It's not told from the perspective of the police or the detective. It's told from the point of view of somebody who's actually in the story. And I absolutely loved that. And I think my first book, Frame Request, and my new book, they're both told from the point of view of one of the characters in the story,
yes,
rather than from the police. So yes. That was a big influence on me, actually, and I read all her books, books. I love them, yeah.
And I mean, you've touched on suspense, and clearly suspense and intrigue is a vital part of a thriller, keeping people turning the pages. But are there any other things that you think are sort of specific ingredients that thrillers have to have?
I don't think there's anything that they have to have. You know, there's all sorts of different kinds of books that fall within that genre. I mean, I think for me, there's got to be kind of tension and suspense and something that keeps you turning those pages. You know, there've got to be questions that need to be answered. There's, you know, there's usually a central question, who done it or why done it or whatever it might be. And obviously, so you've got that. But I think also there's got to be those other little questions and hints that just keep you reading, you know, to find out. And I think for me as a reader and a writer, I want a sort of satisfactory conclusion. I don't mind if there are some loose ends which are not tied up or things which are left a bit ambiguous, but I as a reader feel a bit cheated if the sort of central mystery isn't resolved by the end of the book. As a writer, I wouldn't do that to my readers because I don't like it.
Well, you certainly kept us guessing with Friend Request because, you know, there was lots of people that could possibly have been responsible for what happened. I don't want to spoil the book for anybody that hasn't read it, but you certainly kept us guessing.
Yeah, so I mean, you've got obviously the question of, is Maria still alive? Is it sending the messages?
Yeah.
So that's one question. And then it's like, well, we don't know that. But then if not, then who is sending the messages? And yeah, there's definitely a few options. I think, again, that's something I learned on the course and also from my reading, is that if your mystery is about who is doing something, there's got to be a few different options.
Yes.
Because otherwise it's too obvious, you know. But it's never going to be that the really obvious one. But then if there's only one other one, then you kind of know. I've read a few books recently where I don't often guess, actually, but I have read a few books recently where I have guessed who done it. And I think that's because there's not enough suspects, you know.
Yeah. And I liked very much how, when I realised who was sending the messages, and again, I don't want to spoil it for people, but when I realised when you told us who was sending the messages, I was like, ah, yes, there was a clue earlier on, but I hadn't picked up on it until I knew. So it was fabulous.
That was actually another thing I think I learned on the course, was that, you know, you can't have something that comes completely out of the blue, because again, that feels a bit like cheating the reader. You know, it's got to be, that's exactly what I'm looking for as a writer, is for it to be revealed, for it to be a shock and a surprise. But exactly what you just said, to be able to look back and say, oh yes, of course,
there was a clue, but I missed it when I read.
Oh, well, that's great. I'm delighted.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Why do you think that we're so fascinated by the dark side of human nature? I mean, why are you fascinated by men who break into houses with knives, kidnap small children, or whatever it is they do? What do you think it is that fascinates us about the macabre?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it gives you, when you're reading such a book or writing one, I suppose, a kind of a chance to explore a darker side of life, or maybe even a darker side of yourself, you know, or a side of life that you hopefully won't really have very much to do
with. Yeah.
Kind of a safe way of exploring it. And also, I suppose, again, as we were talking about a satisfactory resolution, if you get to kind of experience that fear or those emotions, but by the end, everything's resolved and everything's okay. So maybe that's reassuring, especially in this, you know, world as it is today.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you mentioned your your new book that's coming out soon. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, yeah. It's called Three Little Lies. It's coming out on the 28th of June.
Oh, so not long to wait now then.
No, not long. That difficult second novel. So it's about a young woman called Ellen whose best friend goes missing. Her best friend's called Sasha. The police are not taking it very seriously, but Ellen has got good reason to fear for Sasha's life and also for her own because of something that happened 10 years before when they gave evidence at the trial of a family friend who's accused of raping another friend of theirs. He's now out of prison, so Ellen has got fears around that. But what we don't know is who was lying back then 10 years ago. Was anybody lying at the trial? Who's lying now? And where is Sasha? Because she's disappeared without a trace.
Mm. And where did you get the idea for that from?
The seed of the idea came from because some of it's told, it's like Friend Request, it's told in two timelines. So one is now and one is 10 years ago when they were sort of about 18. And the way she meets Sasha is Sasha's family move into Ellen Street, and Sasha's family are very glamorous and kind of bohemian. The mother's an opera singer. And Ellen comes from a quite ordinary sort of working class background, and she's absolutely fascinated by this family and drawn into their lives. And that came from a story my husband tells, actually, about a family he knew as a teenager who lived on their street, who were quite bohemian and musical, and they had all these sort of intriguing exotic things in their house, really different to what he knew. So the idea for the family and the characters came from the stories he tells about that, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know really where the rest of it came from, just out of my
imagination. Of course, imagination. Comes of your head. Which is where all the best books do come from. And so that one's ready to come out. So what are you working on at the moment?
I'm working on book three, yeah. So that's a kind of at very early stage. It's I can't really the words to talk about it because I'm not allowed, just because it's such an early stage. Talking about it, just starting to write it, planning it.
So what's your process? Do you plot everything first, or
I seem to be getting more that way as I go along. I sort of had plotted out from because very, very loosely. I think I'd plotted a little bit more for Three Little Lies. And this new book, I think I've probably got more of a plan than I've ever had before. Well, I don't think I could write. I mean, I know some people do, but I don't think I could write this kind of book without knowing where it was going, who did it, or, you know, what really happened or what the end was going to be. I know some people do, but I don't think I could. And also, actually, I'm finding having a plan is helping me to write because I can just kind of look at the plan and think, OK, that's happening next. And sometimes I write it and it comes out differently, which is fine. But I think it's quite helpful to know what's supposed to be happening in the next chapter, even if something slightly ends up happening.
Yeah.
I'm writing it.
So do you start with do you know when you start then how it's going to end? Do you know who did it all the way through?
Yeah.
It doesn't change.
Yeah. So far that hasn't changed. I did have a little bit of a wobble actually halfway through Friend Request, thinking about changing one of the major aspects. Again, I don't want to say too much.
No, spoilers. Because you'll use that next time.
So I did have it, but I ended up going with my original plan, actually. And again, actually, with Three Little Lies, there was a couple of options at the early stages. But once I'd kind of fixed on the option I decided on, I didn't deviate from that.
Fabulous. Well, very best of luck with Three Little Lies. We're all looking forward to it coming out.
Thank you.
So it's the 28th of June.
28th of June,
yeah. Good.
And ebook, it will be out. So.
Fabulous. And have the Audible rights been sold as well?
Yeah, yes, yeah. So it'll be out, I guess that comes out the same day. I guess so.
No, because I know we have lots of listeners who are audiobook fans.
It's got really popular, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, we did some interviews a few months ago. We did a podcast on the rise of audiobook and ebooks and hard copy and the different ways that people are consuming books now, because we were talking about whether we as writers need to consider how it works in an audio form as we're writing. And we interviewed a lot of people who cited busy lives as, you know, the only way to get time to read is to listen on your commute, or
absolutely.
you know, so it was fascinating. Yeah. And of course there are, you know, whether books will ever go straight to audio, who knows?
Well, I suppose, there's plenty, it's only the same as ebooks, I suppose, isn't it? You know, going straight to ebook. But yeah, I know that for publishers, it's a big growth area.
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm. It is fascinating. And, you know, then you have the whole thing about the voice that tells the story, you know, the narrator, and whether the narrator is appealing to the listener.
Yeah. I mean, Friend Request was all narrated by one person, but actually Three Little Lies is going to be narrated because there are actually three narrators in Three Little Lies.
So they're having three voices to
three
do that.
Three actresses, yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think will work really well.
Yeah, because I remember the Poisonwood Bible, which has got four different narrators. Mm-hmm. And I tried to listen to that on in an audio format. The writing was such that I knew who the narrator was by the language that was being used, but yeah. I did actually give up and go back to the book because I just didn't get the same depth of enjoyment, because in my head I had four different voices telling me the story, and so it didn't really work for me. That was one. Yeah. So that sounds good that you've got three different narrators.
Yeah, I think that will work well. Yeah,
that will appeal very much. So. Mm. Yeah, I think we've probably done that. So it's available in all good bookshops.
Yes, yeah.
Waterstones, WH Smith, Amazon, Goodreads, all over the place.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Let's hope everybody could get that on pre-order right now. Laura, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. It's been lovely to meet you.
Oh, you're welcome. I've really enjoyed it.
Good. Best of luck with Three Little Lies.
Thank you.
Well, that was interesting. A lot of good information there from her.
Yeah, she must have been quite a scary little girl.
But what a wonderful thing for your mother to keep all the stories you wrote.
Yeah. Well, it might not.
I think just realised how rubbish I was.
I think I just wanted to write Narnia stories, probably. Not men with knives.
No.
Creeping in the house.
Narnia was quite dark, though.
Yeah.
Thrilling moments in that.
Absolutely.
Well, speaking of all these books, what are your favourite thrillers, Nicola?
Well, I made a little list. The Twilight Zone was the first time I was introduced to thrillers, really, watching the television series with my dad. Oh, it must have been the 70s. I got really into Stephen King, and I galloped through all his books until one day when I was reading The Stand, I think it was, in I was lying in the bath in my rented house, and I realised I was actually too frightened to get out of the bath. So I had to wait till someone else came home, because I got fixated on the fact that I thought there was someone in the house. So I never read another Stephen King book again. And then I, obviously, 24. I was trying to think of things that give me that hot bated breath kind of feel, and 24, the first series of 24, definitely did. But I came back to someone who I mentioned in the detective episode, Kay Scarpetta, fictional character in a series of crime novels. So that she's not described, she did come up in the list of thriller writers, but I find her writing very thrilling because it's very violent sometimes, and tense situations, and I can't think of another description of a thriller than...
Is that Patricia Cornwell?
Yes. Funnily enough, we were just talking about her the other day, weren't we, about her writing about the...
Walter Sickert.
Well, I find her novels kind of scary. Well, they get very scary sometimes because she's finding out a lot of stuff about dead people.
But, you know, it's interesting the difference between her and the person at Kathy Reichs, who writes Bones. You know, Bones and the forensic anthropology thing is a much lighter topic than forensic. What is it that Scarpetta does that's forensic, different?
I don't know.
She's an MA. She's a medical examiner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And somehow those books are much darker than the Kathy Reichs one.
Bones is a forensic anthropologist.
Right. But Bones, isn't that the TV thing?
Yeah, it was books first.
But are they really thrillers or are they detective stories?
Yeah. See, I had Kathy Reichs down as a detective.
This is my problem with the with thriller.
Yeah, that's the definition.
I wasn't sure, so I did go and look for, I just sort of put into the search engine top 10 thriller writers. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the Times or the Sunday Times had a top 25 thriller writers, because I wasn't sure what I've read was a thriller. Yeah. And the first one that was top of the list was An Officer and a Spy by Robert Harris. And I've read that and I loved it.
Oh, he wrote Silence of the Lambs, didn't he?
I think that might be Thomas Harris. Yeah, here we go again. We've done this again.
Okay, that was a thriller.
It's classed as and it was the top in the Times list of thrillers.
Okay.
And for those who haven't read it, it's about the Dreyfus case. So it's historical, looking back to the late 19th century in France. And I was aware of the Dreyfus case as a famous miscarriage of justice, a famous case of basically state institutionalized anti-Semitism, I think you could say. But I didn't know any of the detail of it. So that's a brilliant book, brilliantly researched and well written. Mm-hmm. So that's a thriller, but not... There is detection, of course, but it's not a police...
The ones that have really, I think, I've picked up on in the last few years is what we're calling psychological thrillers.
Yeah.
And that seems to be... I don't know if that was a genre before. I don't remember them. But things like Sleeping with the Enemy by Nancy Price, which has been made into a film... Sometimes I Lie, Alice Feeney, which I read earlier this year.
Right.
Friend Request, obviously. That's a psychological thriller. Before I Go to Sleep, S.J. Watson. That's also been made into a film. Girl on the Train, Gone Girl, Behind Closed Doors, I Let You Go, Into the Darkest Corner. I mean, there's all these.
But do we have a definition of thriller? Or not?
To me, it has to be something which is suspenseful, action-packed, probably not... with lots of literary description. No, it's going to be something fast-paced.
But aren't they scary? Aren't they scary?
Well, they're thrilling, I suppose, by definition.
Yeah, the definition I've looked at said they're characterised and defined by the moods they elicit.
Yeah.
Right.
And another one I thought was really quite interesting. A thriller is usually a villain-driven plot.
Oh, that's interesting.
Whereby like serial killers or something presents obstacles that the protagonist must overcome.
Right, right.
I just thought that's interesting. That thing about the edge of the seat business.
What about you? Do you have a favourite thriller?
I think the ones that Steph's talked about. I mean, I do like Kathy Reichs and Tricia Cornwell, but actually understanding which are the detective ones. And I suppose the type I don't like, because I'm obviously a wimp, the Van Dermot books, I just find too scary.
I think she's a great writer, actually.
I find the graphic detail of the violence too much.
Yeah.
I don't like it at all.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know whether that's going into horror or whether that's a thriller. I'm not really quite sure.
It's not one of her books, it's just some of...
Yes.
Yeah.
Some of her books I would call...
Some
of them are called thrillers.
Yeah.
She seems to.
Ruth Rendell.
Very psychological, aren't they?
Yeah. And then you go into the horror thing. I think that's when the violence gets unreasoning. When it's completely random and it's just someone who loves it for the sake of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, Stephen King's doing a lot of horror and it's not really graphic.
I think horror
very graphic.
Yeah, absolutely. Like
horror the one like with the Freddy?
And The Hills Have Eyes and stuff, where it's lots of gratuitous violence.
I haven't read any of those. I wouldn't, because I get too scared.
Yeah, I think the psychological thriller
is definitely... very contemporary and here to stay.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there are other books that would go into that genre, but it's just we seem to have this kind of new genre of psychological thriller, and it's quite big news, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Silence of the Lamb was, but Jodie Foster's role in that, wasn't she sort of a... Was she a detective?
She was an FBI profiler, wasn't she?
She had to go into... It's what you were saying about your favourite detective the other week.
Yeah.
Somebody that had to use the criminal to...
To get help. So she... I thought she was, like, in some sort of counselling position, like a psychologist or a...
I think she was a new profiler.
But
then she ended up in a relationship with him, didn't she? By book two or three. There were several books. And she definitely ended up in a romantic relationship with him.
With
Hannibal.
No.
She did.
with Linda's face.
We're going off piece. Teresa wanted to say something then, Linda.
Okay.
Oh, no, I was just going to say another name that came up on the list of thriller writers is John le Carré, another writer I really enjoy and admire. The Constant Gardener, for example, which is about corruption in the...
charity business in Africa and so on. He writes very well. And again, it's not detective. He's written spy thrillers and other kinds of thrillers about big business and commerce.
The source I was looking at says that Homer's Odyssey is one of the oldest stories in the Western world and is regarded as an early prototype of the genre.
I've seen that too, yeah.
Really? Well, yeah. By whom? Well, you know. Yeah. As I said before, talking about detectives, you can never find the first, the origin. Yeah. You say this was the first detective story, then you'll find another one.
Yeah.
Or the first vampire story, and then you'll find an older one.
Right, right. Well, all very interesting. I would really like, if there is a listener, maybe you, who could give us your definition of the difference between detective, thriller, and horror. That would be fun. So get in touch with us. Heather's now going to talk about what's on her bedside table. What are you reading now, Heather?
Right, it's called The Power by her author Naomi Alderman. She was the winner of the 2017 Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. I'm not quite sure who recommended this to me because I'm not actually enjoying it very much. But it's written in the far future and it's describing how women became supreme and men became subservient. And so it's written in the 21st century, mm-hmm. but as though it's a historical event.
Oh, okay.
So it's just, I quite like the idea of women being, you know, the supreme beings. I think that's quite good. But I think what's getting to me now is there's quite a lot of violence in it. Mm. And so the women are being violent towards the men. And I just think if women truly were taking over the world, we'd do it far gentler.
Yeah, we're more
subtly, perhaps.
More nurturing. Subtle, yeah. Very gentle, but subtle.
Thank you, Heather. Okay, so we've just about come to the end of our time once more. And before we go, I'd like to tell you about the Winchester Writers Festival. So if any of you are attending the Winchester Writers Festival on 15th, 16th, or 17th June, make sure you collect your free Write Club the Podcast bingo card, which has several writing and reading challenges for you to enjoy. And if you haven't yet booked your place, there's still time. Booking doesn't close until 12th June, and there are still a few places left. Right, Steph?
Mm-hmm.
Just go to writersfestival.co.uk for the details, and we'll post the link on our Facebook group, too. So it's time for us to leave, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.